are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
Revelation chapter 1, he records a series of seven small letters in Revelations 2 through 3. I like to call these mini epistles. They're little letters compared to the other letters of the New Testament. And yet, these messages often get a lot less attention than the other letters. Perhaps there are different reasons for this, but the major New Testament standalone letters by Paul and Peter and James, they get a lot more attention than do these seven little letters. Maybe that's because we overlook these messages because they're overshadowed by the other major independent letters. Or maybe we overlook them, let's be honest, because we are more interested in the events in Revelation 4 through 22. We want to know about the sealed judgments and the mark of the beast and Jesus coming down on a horse with a sword coming out of his mouth and all of the blessings of eternity. We want to read about that. And so we kind of just scoot through Revelations 2 through 3. And then maybe there's this third reason why we don't know as much about Revelation 2 through 3. Maybe it's because we just don't understand them. Maybe we don't understand these letters. We feel a little confused. We begin to read them and then we say, wait, I don't know what this is talking about. And so we just kind of, again, scoot through and get to the rest of the book. We might ask questions like, were these written to actual churches? What am I supposed to know about these churches? We might ask questions like, what does it mean to be lukewarm? Or what does it mean to lose your first love? Who are the Nicolaitans? And who is this Jezebel lady that I thought was just in the Old Testament? How does she show up again in one of these letters? And then what is the throne of Satan? And one question we're going to answer tonight, who are these overcomers that are mentioned at the end of each of these letters? And what about all these rewards, a white throne, a mark on my head, a special secret manna that I get to eat? Is that chocolate chip cookies in heaven? Is there something that I don't know about that's going to be tasty? So all the kids want to know about the secret manna, right? What about these rewards that we're told about? Now, these questions are good questions, and they're questions we're going to have to talk about as we go through these letters. But let me just remind us that as we study these letters, we should give them just as much devotion and attention as we do to Romans, Hebrews, 1 Peter, and so on. They're just as important. We need to understand them, and by understanding them, these letters are supposed to help us persevere with peace and confidence through the difficult trials and hardships that we face as Christians. That is supposed to be the effect that these letters have on us. So, tonight I was going to study the church at Ephesus and the letter to the Ephesians, but I couldn't. Instead, I had to give us a lesson that gives us an overview and a framework for all seven letters first, so that we can understand them as we go through them one at a time. Let's begin tonight by talking about the purpose for these letters. Now, as we read about these letters, there are two methods of interpretation that we can follow. And these methods will come out of what we view as the purpose for these letters. Some people suggest that we should read these letters with a historical frame of reference. They are written for a historical purpose, the purpose of actually diagnosing the spiritual condition of certain churches in the first century. Other people suggest that we should read these letters and interpret them with a prophetic purpose in mind. The prophetic purpose being what I'm about to describe. Those people who suggest that we should read this set of seven letters with a prophetic mindset would say something like this, that these seven letters represent a series of seven eras, periods of time that will play out throughout church history. Maybe you've heard this before. If you go online, you can find some very interesting charts and diagrams that break this all down for you. The prophetic viewpoint. The prophetic viewpoint proposes something like this, if you can see it on the slide. They will say this, that Ephesus represents the apostolic period. That's when the church was new and fresh, from AD 33 to AD 100, approximately. And you have to throw approximately in because we're not exactly sure what the dates are. It's not like you wake up one day and you're all of a sudden out of one era in church history and now, bang, you're in the next era. Then they say that this era ended when the apostles died. They'll say then that if you read about the church at Smyrna, that you actually read the qualities of the persecuted church era, AD 100 to AD 313. You say, wow, why 313? That sounds very specific. Well, because that's the year that Emperor Constantine merged, in his mind, what he thought was Christianity with the Roman Empire. And so the Roman Catholic Church's foundation was kind of laid in AD 313. And so people will say that was a clean break. And that then leads to the compromised church from AD 313 to 590. Then they'll say that the church in Thyatira represents the corrupt church, AD 590 to about AD 1517. That was a long period compared to the apostolic era, which was very, very short. And so they'll say this represents the Dark Ages, the time of the Middle Ages, the medieval period of time when everything was spooky and dark and no one knew anything and all the rich people ate fancy food and the popes just walked around speaking in Latin and no one knew anything else. Now, I'm making fun of that a little bit, but that's the idea. And then they'll say that it ended when Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the church. And so from AD 1517 to about 1750, you have the Reformation era of the church. They say that this period of time then ran, that would be the church at Sardis, that would lead then to the church of Philadelphia, which was a generally good church. And that is the missionary evangelistic zeal period of church history, when the church was winning souls for the first time all around the world. William Carey and Adoniram Judson and Hudson Taylor and all these people were spreading the gospel all around the world. And there was great spiritual awakenings during this period of time. And then, about AD 1900 until now, they say, is the Laodicean age, the age of the lukewarm church. And people who take this view will say things like, we are now living in the Laodicean age, and we don't know how long it's going to last, but it's the bad part of church history, and we're just lukewarm. And it's going to be that way until the end of this period. Now, interpretations like this arose out of curiosity. They're very interesting. You can study these different charts and diagrams that break it down. You're going to find the guys' charts always have different dates. They always have different labels for the periods of time. And really, who's to say that there are seven periods of time, right? There are some serious flaws with this kind of way of reading about these seven letters. And this approach is just simply not based on any kind of reliable Bible study method. Let me give you reasons why I say that. First of all, if you live in the first century and you sit down to read the book of Revelation and you get to Revelation 2 through 3, you have absolutely no reason in the world from anything that is said in the book of Revelation that these two chapters are talking about the next seven episodes of church history. There's nothing that even tells you anything like that. Nothing in these letters or the surrounding material of Revelation indicates at all that John was foreshadowing a future period of time in seven stages. The only way to reach this conclusion is to look back from about 1900 or 1950 backwards and come up with this idea. Oh, wow, I think I see church history here. Well, that doesn't help anybody. And even then, who's to say when the Reformation era begins? When does the missionary era end? I mean, we are still sending out missionaries around the world. And so this is very ambiguous and very subjective. In this view, if it were true, you have to ask a question like this. What's the purpose of this point anyway? Let's pretend that I actually did figure out when John wrote the book of Revelation, and I'm in a church, and I realize, wait, I think I'm in the first century, and I'm looking at these two chapters, and I think this is the next seven eras of church history. What does that do? What is the purpose of that? How does that help me at all? It doesn't serve any purpose. It only salves curiosity and makes me feel like I've discovered something super special in the Bible. In fact, believers in the first century actually believed, for good reason, that Jesus Christ could have come back in their lifetime. That doesn't mean that he had to, any more than it means he has to right now in our generation. But they believed Christ could come within their lifetime just as we do. And that is just as possible for us as it was for them. Now, that is what they believed. In fact, John the Apostle actually taught this himself. Paul suggested that he believed that Christ could return in that generation, 1 Thessalonians 4:15 to 17. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 28. John taught the believers in the first century, and this is true for us today as well, that they should be ready for Christ to appear. They should purify themselves so that when Christ appears, they would be ready to see him. He didn't say, by the way, I am saying this to people for seven church episodes later. Don't worry, you can skip this. This is for a future generation. No, he said it right to the people in the first century. And at the end of the book of Revelation, chapter 22 and verse 20, he says, even so, after all the book of Revelation is written, come, Lord Jesus. That was a prayer he prayed in the first century. So it really seems like not even John himself had the idea that seven eras of church history had to pass first. This view also overlooks or minimizes the simple, observable fact that these cities were placed in a particular order based upon their location in a circular postal route. We've talked about this before. There's a geographical reason why they were listed in the order that they were. This is the order you would travel to take this letter to these churches in these cities. This was not an order given for some mystical, supernatural, future eras of time sequence or something of this nature. Finally, and I think this is very important, it's also common sense. It is impossible to, at any point in church history, describe the worldwide church in the same way for all the churches at that moment. We can't say today, the church today is in a lukewarm state. Because what you're saying is, really, what preachers are usually saying is, all the churches in my association that I'm familiar with in America are not as good as they're supposed to be. If you want to be more accurate, though, what you're really supposed to say, if this view is true, all the churches in the world right now are lukewarm. How can you say that? How can you say that all the churches during the Dark Ages were all corrupt? How can you say that all the churches in the first apostolic era were all just fledgling and excited for the Lord? Because Paul wrote some pretty serious things to some pretty carnal Christians in Corinth. In fact, all six of the other churches were alive and well while anyone else was reading the church letter to themselves. So the church at Ephesus was in a certain spiritual state, but all six other churches were in very different spiritual states at the exact same time, but in the same region. So how can you say that the church at Ephesus describes all seven churches? You can't do that. Another problem with that view is that we're usually talking about the eras of church history from an Anglo-European Western mindset. We're saying, for instance, that modern missions only got started in the 1700s when some white guy in UK decided to be a missionary. But I thought I heard a couple of weeks ago from Justin Levine that missions was alive and well in India in the first century. You see what I'm saying? And there are some places in the world right now where the church is under extreme persecution and duress on first century levels. Don't dare call them, and there's whole sections of the world in some places, lukewarm. And so this idea that these seven churches represent seven eras in church history, and we are now living in the Laodicean age, let me just tell you, you can take those charts and just throw them away because they're irrelevant. They're fanciful, creative thinking, but they have nothing to do with reality. The proper way to study and understand these seven small messages is to interpret them as letters written to seven particular congregations in the first century in Asia Minor to diagnose their spiritual condition at that time. By following this approach, we are not saying that they have no relevance for us today. Because to say that would also mean to say that all the other letters in the New Testament were only relevant for the churches that they were written to. Romans was only relevant to Rome, and Corinth was only supposed to receive 1 and 2 Corinthians. We don't need to read them. That is not the point. We should first, as we read about these letters, ask, what can we learn as a church in our present condition? To underscore this question that we should ask as we look at these seven churches, let me underscore this by pointing out what it says in Revelation 2:7. Revelation 2:7, and in every other one of these letters, there is a phrase at the end, what the Spirit says to this church. Is that what it says? It says what the Spirit says to the churches. The idea is it's a letter written to a particular church, but it's also expecting to catch the ears of other churches too. It's a public conversation. It's like this. It's if I reach out and say to my son, Josh, and I'm talking to Josh about something, but I'm doing it right here, right now. Everyone who's listening on live stream and in person is also hearing this. That's the idea. Christ, through John, is through the Spirit, speaking to a particular church in each letter, but he's also expecting to do it in audience of the other churches. Other churches. And by the way that John arranged this and circulated this entire book, we know that he intended this entire section to be read by each congregation. What I mean by that is, if you were at Ephesus in that church and the scroll of Revelation was carried into town, and it was announced that a messenger is going to read a prophetic book from Pastor John, the Apostle John, who's imprisoned on Patmos, he's going to update you on his status, and you're going to get some real meat and some prophecy that's going to encourage your heart. come. And so you come and they read chapter 1 to you about the commission of John and the vision of Christ, and you're just overawed at the exalted Christ and so glad that John shared that vision with you. And then you get to Revelation 2 and to the church at Ephesus. You say, oh, he's saying something to us. Your eyes and your ears would tune in. And then next, to the church at Smyrna. And the messenger says, oh, okay, just a second. I'm going to skip that. All right, Revelation chapter 4. The other parts of those two chapters were for the other churches, so we'll keep that private. That is not what happened. Those seven letters were expected to be read to all seven churches. And you were not supposed to go take a water break while the other six letters were being read. You were supposed to listen to those too. Okay, so this is a book. These are letters intended for other churches to listen to. We also need to ask a second question, though. This is not just our chance to sit and ask the question, do we have a good or a bad church? Is our church like one of the good churches? Is our church like one of the bad churches? Are we a lukewarm church? Are we an on-fire church? What kind of church are we? And that's not what we look at these books for alone. Instead, we have to ask another question as well. Look at Revelation chapter 2 and verse 7 again. What does John say? He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. If you read each of these letters, you know that they use a lot of plural pronouns, which means talking to the group. You have these kind of works, you have this kind of behavior, you have tolerated these kind of people, you are listening to this kind of doctrine, you are behaving in this kind of way. It's a group discussion. I do that when I preach. We talk to the group. But at this point in Revelation 2:7, and this happens in all the other letters as well, he that has an ear, what happens? What's the change? What's the shift? He shifts from plural to singular. Now he's speaking to the individuals in the group. He's saying, not only do I want churches to listen to these letters to have a proper diagnosis of their church's spiritual condition. Otherwise, that'd be way too easy. We'd all sit around and just say, yeah, my pastor needed to do a better job of that. Yeah, everyone else in my church, definitely lukewarm. I'm waiting for it to change. We have a very lukewarm church. That is not what we're here to do, right? You diagnose the spiritual condition of your church as you compare and contrast it with these seven case studies. But you also have to listen individually. Because the spiritual condition of a church is tied directly to the spiritual condition of its independent members. You cannot change a lukewarm church without its members moving out of lukewarmness one person at a time. You don't change the church as a group. You change the church as individuals. Now, we have teachers in our church, right? And you understand as a teacher that to get your class average up, you have to engage individual students one at a time. You cannot just content yourself with speaking to the group. You have to dig in one-on-one to get the group average up. And that's what Paul is doing. He's getting individuals to listen in so that they can diagnose themselves. So with these thoughts in mind, I think that the purpose of the letters has been established. We need to read these letters not with a prophetic viewpoint of predicting seven eras in church history. We can discard that. I am not going to refer to that at any other point in time in a positive way. But we need to read these seven letters with two lenses. Glasses have two lenses, right? Lens number one, how does my church's spiritual condition compare and contrast to these seven examples? We may not necessarily find a church that is a one-for-one match, right? We'll probably see some qualities in each of these churches. We'll probably be some kind of a conglomeration of these seven churches. But the other lens is, how do I and my spiritual condition compare to what I'm reading about in these letters? It's my ear that works, that needs to be listening. I am supposed to be eavesdropping individually on what the Spirit is saying to all the churches, because I have an important role in that. Now let's move to taking a look at the pattern of these letters. As we study these seven letters, we're going to soon recognize that each letter follows a similar pattern. You can see the four main sections of each letter, and each letter doesn't follow this precisely. There's usually some kind of variation, some stylistic difference in each of the letters. So it's not a wooden, repeated pattern, but it's a general pattern that you'll see in these seven letters. Reading the seven letters reminds me of the way my mom taught me to write thank you notes as a kid. Every time I got a gift or a card from anybody or anyone did me a favor, I had to sit down at the kitchen table after doing my errands and chores and do an extra chore before I could do anything else. I had to write thank you notes. And I would sit down and my thank you notes would be blank and empty. Mom would give them to me and I would say something like this. Dear so-and-so, thank you for the fill in the blank. It was very nice. I liked it. Mom, how is that? She would look at it. She'd say, well, say something personal. What else can I say? Well, think about that person. Think about what they were thinking when they got it for you. Say something nice. And so I had to sit there and come up with something personal. Then I would write another card. Dear so-and-so, thank you for the fill in the blank. I really liked it. It was nice. And if I said the same personal thing to the next person as I did to the first person, my mom would say, no, you can't just repeat. You had to think of something that's actually personal, that's actually different. By the way, this still runs through my mind now as a pastor. When you get birthday cards and anniversary cards and thank you cards from me, I do usually write them all at about the same time in the course of a month. That's one little secret. I have a stack, and I go through that stack in one sitting, usually. However, if you ever decided to sit down and compare birthday cards and anniversary cards with everybody else in your same month, you will not find that they say the same thing. They are different, I promise. Now, you could try to compare them with what I said to you last year. I don't keep track of it like that. Hopefully it is personal, fresh, and new. That would be an interesting study. But we're not studying my birthday cards, thankfully. We are studying Pastor John's letters to seven churches, and there is a basic pattern to what he does with variations. Here's the pattern. The beginning of the letter is an introduction to the messenger and church. Then, that follows with a description of Christ. Following the description of Christ is an assessment of the church's spiritual condition. And finally, that follows with a promise of personal blessing. Let's talk about, first of all, the personal introduction. The personal introduction opens by saying something like this. To the angel of the church in fill in the blank, write. And you say, oh, here's the form letter again. Yeah, this is my dear so-and-so, thank you for the present. It was nice. Each letter basically starts the same way. We've already talked about this in previous lessons in this series so far, but the angel, people talk about who is this angel. And if you know a little bit of Greek, enough to be dangerous, you know that the word angel is angelos, and it can be translated as angel or messenger. And so we read to the angel at the church of whatever, and we wonder sometimes, is this an actual guardian angel? That doesn't make any sense. Now, there are a lot of angels in the book of Revelation, but these are not angels, okay? When a word means the same thing, sometimes you have to use it in different ways because it's the only word available to you. The word angel here does not mean guardian angel, and here's one of the reasons why. Because why would Jesus give John, a human being, a vision to write down certain letters to churches, also filled with people, but then give those letters to angels? And how would you even do that? And how did an angel get that letter then to the church? So, yes, it's a fascinating idea that makes absolutely no sense. And so you can just simply cross it off your list. Some people say, well, then, what is the messenger to a church? This is the pastor of the church. The problem with that view is that's a total guess. Nowhere else in the entire Bible does the word angel ever refer to a pastor. The more easy answer is simply to say it's referring, because it's obviously not referring to an angel, to a messenger. How do you get letters to churches in the first century when you're a guy who is in prison on an island? The same way that Paul delivered letters to churches when he was in prison in Rome, and so on. How do you do that? You assign the job to a messenger, a personal delivery boy or girl, usually a fellow Christian who wanted to help you out and be a part of the mission at hand. Often it was somebody from that church. It was not a safe job. It was a dangerous job because you had to spend a lot of nights under the stars and do a lot of footwork and figuring out how to get from A to B and riding boats in the open water and walking by foot and figuring out what to do at nighttime, hoping somebody will take you in and you might get robbed or beat up if you looked like you had something valuable, so on and so forth. Being a messenger was an adventurous task, but it wasn't necessarily easy. So, to the angel of the church, meaning this is the person who is delivering the message to this church. And then there is a mention of the name of each church and its location. We've talked about this enough, I think, that the seven churches are beginning here at Patmos in order. The boat would have went over to Ephesus, first letter at Ephesus church, then Smyrna, and so on, in a big circle. Another fascinating thing to know about is that this scroll, the letter would have been written on a scroll, a papyrus scroll, and that paper scroll would have been about 15 feet long. That'd be quite a thing to carry around, right? You hope no one knocks you off for it, because books were precious in those days, scrolls, and people might want to kind of take that thing from you. So that was not an easy task. As a messenger, this person would then have carried the scroll by boat from the island of Patmos to Ephesus by foot or whatever means he could come up with. And then it would have been announced that he was present and he was going to read the scroll. We don't know if he read the scroll all at once, all 22 chapters. Would you like me to do that tonight? You want me to read all 22 chapters tonight? You're probably already watching your clocks. That would be a long reading session. It's possible that they did and took all of Sunday to read the whole letter. It's also possible that they kept, like a library loan, kept the scroll for a couple of months or a couple of weeks and broke it down into sessions and had different reading sessions to get through. Did this reader read the scroll through just once? Or did they read it through a second time and have a second showing, a second reading, so to speak, to get all the people who didn't come to church the first time or who missed certain episodes? We don't actually know the answers to these questions that I'm aware of. But once this reading assignment was complete, then another person from the next church would come and take that scroll the next length of the journey, which would usually take at least several days. And they would arrive and they would get their turn with the scroll. And that's how this job would go. The messenger. Let me also make a note of the description of Christ. The description of Christ is something that appears in each of these letters. Christ is referred to in different ways. First of all, the letter usually says something like, "These things says." These things says, and we might skim right over that very quickly, but that phrase, "these things said," in Greek, this is more obvious, is a way of announcing something that is going to be said in the way that a Persian king would say, "I have a declaration to make. Thus says King so-and-so." Or, as is more prevalent in the Old Testament, more elevated, this is what was said frequently by the Old Testament prophets when they had a declaration from Yahweh, from God of the ages. They would say this only in Hebrew. And so this is a neat little tidbit here indicating that these are not just letters, these are messages from God that are to be read with real seriousness. It also is a little hint that Jesus, who is speaking as though he is Jehovah. Pretty neat. Each letter also refers then back to a description of Jesus borrowed, kind of cut and pasted, or not cut. This is the book of Revelation, and it says at the end, don't take anything out. So it's copied and pasted from Revelation 1. Verses 12 to 18. Some aspect, some detail or other from John's vision of Christ, maybe the sword coming out of his mouth, or the eyes as a flame of fire, or the feet like hot glowing metal coming out of the furnace. Different details of that vision reappear in these letters. And these details remind us that the description of Jesus from John in Revelation 1 is not to be forgotten. It was not just for John. It was for the churches as well. And the things that are mentioned each have specific application to the situation that that particular church is facing. Sometimes different qualities and features of our Lord Jesus Christ are more helpful to us than others, right? Sometimes we need to know of his justice. Other times we need to know of his compassion and his gentleness, or his power to rule and to reign, and so on. And so that is also fascinating. And then there is usually this announcement, "I know your works." That's like your parent stepping into the room when you're a kid and saying, "I know what you're doing." Sometimes they catch you stealing something out of the refrigerator that you are too hungry to wait for. Other times, they might catch you wrapping a present for their birthday. Other times, they might just be being nice, and the parent caught them is a little bit surprised. But that's what's going on here. Jesus is displaying absolute, comprehensive, and intimate knowledge of the true spiritual nature of that church and the people in it. Jesus knows this church, Faith Baptist Church, like every other church, better than any pastor, deacon, or member will ever know it. He knows our works. If you're dabbling with or fallen down in sin as a member of a church, then these words shouldn't make you just get scared, but they should make you wake up and turn back to the one who knows. He knows what you're doing, and he's just patiently watching and waiting for you to get right. And that should make you respond this way. But if you're striving to live for Christ in the face of difficult circumstances, wrestling with temptations and dependence upon Christ, and even feeling like other Christians are misjudging you, feeling like you're unfaithful, but you know in your heart you're giving it your best, you're just not perfect, Christ knows. He knows the true nature of your heart. Following this introduction to Jesus Christ in each letter, there's an assessment of the spiritual nature of the church. This is the bulk of each letter. This is the meat of each letter, and I'm going to save this for each letter when we study them individually. But Let me just say this, that each section features positive qualities and negative qualities. Mostly. There's a couple of places where it doesn't. For instance, Smyrna and Philadelphia have no real negative qualities mentioned. Those are the churches we hope that we're like, right? But then there's the church at Laodicea. This is the church that has no positive qualities mentioned at all. That's really bad. That was by the time the letter got to Laodicea, it was letter number 7. The people at Laodicea knew everyone else has heard about them. Everyone else knows we're really in bad shape. This is utterly embarrassing, right? That's Laodicea. So there is this part of the church. And let me just say, generally speaking, when you think of your church, you tend to think, I have a great church, or I have a terrible church. It's never usually that simple. Usually your church has a mixture of positive and negative qualities. Sometimes we visit a church on vacation, or we learn a lot about our relative's church because of all the stuff that they tell us, and so on. And sometimes we listen to these or visit these other churches, and then we come back to ours and we say, our church needs to get better. Our church needs to learn from this other church. That's a better church. And eventually, maybe I'll start going to that church instead. And so we have these kind of ideas in our heads. But the fact of the matter is, people from that church may come here and say, oh, that church, we need to be like that church because they do this, this, and this, and we don't. Our pastor never even talks about that. Oh, we have a bad church. The fact of the matter is, most churches have good and bad qualities. And we all need to learn from each other, to grow together, and to get better where we can. So, the close of each letter, this is where we're going to finish tonight. There is first a universal appeal to everyone. There's a promise of personal blessing at the end. He that has an ear, let him hear. This is every individual. What the Spirit says to all the churches, this is every church. This universal presentation to the whole group. Churches, everyone sitting in the churches and listening. But then there is also this special reward given at the end, a reward for true believers. To him who overcomes, I will give, and then there's some kind of a little incentive or blessing that is mentioned. Who are these overcomers? This is something that is debated. Let me talk about this, and we're going to close with this tonight. Some people suggest that overcomers are people who are genuinely born again for a little while, but then they fail, and they forfeit their salvation. They lose their salvation. They withdraw from Christ because the pressure got too great, and so they leave the faith, and they backslide, and they lose their salvation. Now, people who suggest this idea believe that there is no such thing as eternal assurance of salvation. But that simply disagrees with what John himself has clearly recorded Jesus Christ as teaching. If you go back to John's Gospel in John chapter 10, there are many reasons alone in John 10, 27 to 30, indicating that there is no way in the world that you can be removed from your salvation. Once you believe on Christ and respond to him as the true shepherd in faith for salvation, no one and nothing can remove you from his hand at all. It's impossible. Then, of course, John is the one who wrote John 3:16, whoever believes on me will receive what? Everlasting life. You can't lose that because it doesn't stop. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. We've talked about this. Faith Baptist Church does not teach that you can lose your salvation. That is not a valid view in this passage. Some, though, who actually rightly affirm the doctrine of eternal security will suggest this, that though you cannot lose your salvation, this identity of overcomers is a special label given to describe some Christians who are victorious Christians, people who live the victorious Christian life, as opposed to people who live the defeated Christian life, if there's such a thing. So that's what they will say these overcomers are. And so what happens in this viewpoint is that Christ is kind of tantalizing you to be a victorious Christian so that you stop being a defeated Christian. According to this view, all Christians receive eternal life. Only some Christians get the bonus blessings, the extra special blessings. Only the victorious Christians get that secret bread. So, if you're motivated by food, let me tell you, the only other thing I know you eat in heaven is fruit and veggies. So, I want to get that secret bread as well. I want the VIP menu. So I want to be a victorious Christian, right? So that's the idea. I mean, the victorious Christian gets the white robes. What does the non-victorious Christian get to wear? I don't know. So that's the idea here. We all get into God's eternal kingdom, but some of us get special blessings because we were victorious. These people will say this is for the spirit-filled Christian. The carnal Christian doesn't get this stuff. But that raises a lot of other unusual questions, like, does that mean someone who always lives spirit-filled? Or does that mean someone who lived a carnal Christian life, but the last couple weeks they got with it and had revival, and so they were walking in the Spirit when they died, and so they still qualified? But what about the person who lived a very spiritually fruitful, truly spiritual life for decades and then fell apart and was depressed for the last month of their existence, and they died in spiritual depression? Were they finally and ultimately defeated and therefore disqualified? Or is it a mathematical thing where those who live spirit-filled more than half the time qualify? Or 75%? I mean, how do we know? How do you know? And they'll say, well, you have to leave that up to God. Well, I do believe in leaving things up to God, but that doesn't make any sense. That's confusing. That's not motivating. That's frustrating. It's like telling kids, the good kids get to stay up late tonight, and the bad kids don't. What's a good kid? One who does good things. What's a bad kid? One who does bad things. Well, how many do I have to do? Just do a good job. With reference to what? So, you kind of know what I think about this view, I think. We're going to talk a little bit more about that and drive that stake in. But the preferred identification for these overcomers mentioned at the end of these letters is simple. It's those who have followed Christ and truly have believed. That's what this is talking about. It's talking about Christians who actually finished the race as Christians because they were Christians. It's people who, from the beginning to the end of their profession of faith, profess faith in Christ because they believed in Christ. It's not talking about people who we thought were following Christ but failed along the way and never got back because they never were there. John said in his letter, 1 John, there are people that depart out from among us. Why? Because they never were actually of us. That is not an overcomer. That is a professor. Here are some things to take note of then. In 1 John, John wrote 1 John, right? John wrote in 1 John as a pastor writing to believers that he was responsible for, that overcomers are those who believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Look at this. John 16:33. Well, did I give you the right verse? Here we go. This is not right either. Look it up in your Bibles. 1 John 5, 4 through 5. He says this. Who is an overcomer? those who believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. This is our victory that overcomes the world. How do you overcome the world? You believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And if that's what you have done, guess what? You go out of this world having overcome it. You go out a believer who was not thrown down by this world. There's more to say about this, of course, right? John 20 and verse 31, the end of John's gospel, says, John wrote the gospel of John that we would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that we would have life through his name. According to 1 John, that's called being an overcomer. Every true believer overcomes the world. There is no such thing as a Christian who is not an overcomer. An overcomer is a believer. Very simple. Also, when John speaks of overcoming, he refers primarily to the overcoming that comes from Christ, not me, not my performance. This is not me seeing how many stars I get on my heavenly chart. Did I get enough to qualify for the prize? No. John 16:33. These things, he writes in his gospel, have I spoken to you that in me, Jesus said, you may have peace. A reason for revelation as well. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. The key here to being an overcomer is believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Believe that he is the one to trust in, to rely upon, to depend on, and to follow. And follow him in faith for the rest of your life. You're going to get tempted to not do that. You'll have days where you're not doing a very good job. That person who truly has believed will come out of that and will finish strong. The person who doesn't wasn't ever believing anyway. I could give you other verses. 1 John 4:4, I think I have mentioned as well. You are of God, little children. So, who is he speaking of? Believers. And have overcome them. Because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. This is a positional thing, isn't it? It's the question of whether or not I am under the power of the God of this world, or I am in Christ under God's authority, with God in me. Here he's referring to the Antichrist, false teachings and influences in the world that push you away from Christ. In 1 John also, we have this reference to the little children. The little children is one of the ways that John, all throughout his letter of 1 John, refers to true believers. If the Apostle John walks up to you and says, "Hi, little child, how's it going?" You'd say, "That's weird." And someone else would say, "That's what John does." He's a pastor, he's a very gentle, tender guy, and didn't always used to be that way, he was pretty rough, but that's just what he calls all the people in his church, little children. What does that mean? It means he's pretty sure you're a real Christian, and he wants to take care of you and make sure that you're nurturing your relationship with Jesus. So this matter of being a little child is equated then to being an overcomer. Hi, little child. Don't forget, you're an overcomer now. Don't forget that. That's the idea. And then, Revelation 21 and verse 7. He who overcomes, this is the end of the book of Revelation, he who overcomes shall inherit all, you could add these, all these things, and I will be his God and he shall be my son. What are all these things? Well, you have to look at the previous verses in Revelation 21. He says things in verse 3 like, you will have God dwelling with you, and you will be his people. Verse 4 of Revelation 21, He will wipe all tears away from your eyes. And in Revelation 21:5, he said that God will make everything new. Is that only for victorious Christians? Do the carnal, defeated Christians have to spend eternity with tears in their eyes, with old stuff and not new stuff? Are they the ones that are not considered the same group of God's people? Do they have to live kind of outside the city walls? No, that's crazy. That's not consistent. John is talking here about true believers. He's picking up in chapter 21 where he left off talking to the churches. Overcomers get all this stuff because they're in Christ. It's also contrasted with the people that get thrown into the lake of fire in verse 8. So either you're an overcomer or you're cast into the lake of fire. If there is a third group, like defeated Christians, that don't qualify for all these blessings, but don't get thrown into the lake of fire, they're just not mentioned anywhere in the book of Revelation. Who are these unidentified defeated Christians that John never speaks of? Well, I don't know. They're kind of overlooked children, aren't they? They're not mentioned because it's not a group of people that John is speaking about. If the overcomers in Revelation 2 through 3 are only victorious Christians, I would contend all Christians end victorious, but not the so-called carnal Christians, then these letters are ultimately frustrating and unhelpful because they don't really tell non-victorious Christians anything about what's going to happen to them. It's just, you don't get mentioned and you don't get all these things. And you better hope you're a real Christian, because if not, then you're going to have these things happen to you. Not very helpful. Some of the rewards, I'm going to finish with this, previewed in these letters also, clearly refer to rewards given to all believers, not some. Those who overcome, Revelation 2:11, will, what's their reward? Not be hurt by the second death. So what about the defeated Christians? Do they get hurt by the second death? And you can look that up in Revelation 20 and verse 6, verse 14, 21:8. Those who are liars and unbelievers get cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. But those who are overcomers, they get all these things. So if you believe those are victorious only type Christians, super spiritual Christians, then what about the middle group? Do they get touched by the second death? I hope not. That doesn't make any theological sense. Then Revelation 2:7 mentions overcomers will be allowed to eat from the tree of life. What about the rest of the Christians? I thought this is something that all Christians get to do. If you read Revelation 22 and verse 2 and verse 14, all are invited to eat from the tree of life. Well, so what kind of prize is this in Revelation speaking to Ephesus? I'm going to be a victorious Christian because I want to eat from the tree of life. But then you find out at the end of the book, everyone kind of gets to eat from the tree of life. That's not fair. Like, you are tempting me with a participation prize. You made it look like it was a trophy that only some people got. But I guess everyone gets to, Okay, I'm being facetious, but you have to answer this better if you're going to take that view. What's more, Christians who are victorious, overcoming Christians, it says in Revelation 3:5, Christ will not blot out their names from the book of life. Well, that's good to know. But what about the defeated Christians? Could their name be blotted out of the book of life, whatever that means? Well, if you read Revelation, that's really problematic. Philippians 4:3, Matthew 10, 32, Luke 12, 8 speak about this book of life. Also, it says that Christ will profess or confess their name before the Father. Does that mean that there are some Christians Christ will just doesn't really want to talk to God about because they were defeated? He just wants to talk about the real victorious ones. That has serious theological flaws, doesn't it? Because I thought Christ intercedes for every Christian and goes before the Father for all of us. Again, Matthew 10 and Luke 12 speak about him not doing this as being evidence that these are people who are going to be judged for eternity in hell. And so this idea that overcomers is this special class of Christians who really get it going spiritually is just not taught in these letters or really in the New Testament much at all. There is such a thing as overcomers who are not acting like overcomers at certain periods of time or not overcoming as well as they should be, yes, but they're still overcomers at all times in their Christian life. That's why it's a sorry shame when they don't act like it, because they are overcomers, and they're going to be treated like that in eternity. Ultimately, these letters are designed not to help us figure out who are the especially spiritual Christians and who are not. These letters are designed to help us figure out, are we living out our victory as we should or not? And are we walking by faith because we're genuine children of God who will remain that way to the last breath? Is there anything that could throw you out of it? If you're a true believer, the answer is no. And you have a lot to look forward to, even if the in-between is filled with a lot of struggles and trials to your faith.